There was no collusion at all. No collusion.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many. They always say the lawyer, and then they like to add the fixer. Well, I don't know if he's a fixer.
But Rudy knows it's a witch hunt. He started yesterday. He'll get his facts straight.
I understood Michael Cohen very well. Turned out he wasn't a very good lawyer, frankly.
Says who?
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, a special series from Left, Right, and Center. Our show is all about President Trump's legal issues, which are complicated, and they bring up really good questions about free speech and defamation and Nixon tattoos and whether the president can be sued or forced to testify while he's in office. It was clear we needed to devote some time every week to answering some of the biggest legal questions, so I called Ken White. Ken is a criminal defense attorney in Los Angeles and was formerly a federal prosecutor. Ken blogs about the law at popehat.com. He hosts the First Amendment podcast, Make No Law, and he's my co-host and legal navigator on this show. Hello, Ken.
Hi, Josh.
So Roger Stone was arrested on Friday morning at his home in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. He's been charged with obstruction of justice, witness tampering, and five counts of making false statements, all related to his behavior during probes of Russian involvement in the 2016 election. First, Ken, let's talk about the arrest itself. We all saw the arrest on CNN. Is it fair to describe this as a perp walk?
Well, it's not clear whether or not it's a deliberate perp walk. So the feds, like most law enforcement agencies, have a long and inglorious history of leaking the time and place of arrests to humiliate the defendants and have them seen on TV being walked away in handcuffs. This time, although it was my inclination to think that's what happened, there's some indication that CNN just used some good journalism and picked up the signs that there was unusual grand jury activity, thought about the several people who could be arrested the next day, and had camera crews staked out. So it's not clear whether or not anyone leaked it or whether it was a deliberate perp walk by the government.
Was the show of force itself related to the arrest excessive? Someone in and ask them to surrender, but I imagine they might have had some particular reasons why they thought it was necessary to go get Roger Stone early in the morning.
Well, they were going to do a search of the location anyway, so that involves a fairly large amount of personnel and force. And to be fair to the government, Stone has videotaped himself with guns, and he's made what may or may not be jokes about how federal agents could be shot and that type of thing. So some level of prudence might have been warranted. And also it's important to point out, I think, that this is the type of force that gets used all the time against people who aren't 66-year-old white guys accused of white-collar crimes without much notice by anybody. So although it might seem excessive if you don't know Roger Stone or know the way the system typically works, ultimately I don't think it was.
Do you read anything into the fact that all these crimes he's been indicted for relate to behavior during the investigation itself? I mean, one of the raps you get on this investigation from some defenders of Trump is that basically they invented a bunch of crimes by investigating people and then tripping people up and people commit crimes in the course of the investigation. Now, obviously, that has not been true of everyone. You had Michael Cohen, who, you know, engaged in a conspiracy to make an illegal campaign contribution before anyone was investigating his campaign contribution behavior. You, of course, have all these tax and bank fraud charges. But here it looks like Roger Stone, if he goes down, he's going down for stuff he did after investigators started taking interest in Roger Stone.
Well, that's true, but that's a feature, not a bug. That's the way the system routinely works. People get hooked up not because the government's able to successfully investigate and prove some underlying bad behavior, but because what they did during the investigation. Here, I think that Stone's indictment reads like a further example of what we talked about before, of the special counsel using indictments and sentencing documents and things like that as a way to give a preview of what his report may be later. So yes, most of the conduct it describes that's criminal is after the investigation, but it also gives a window into a Trump campaign that is clearly very interested in getting dirt from WikiLeaks. It has Stone in communication with the Trump campaign, and it has some high-level Trump campaign congratulating Stone after there's a WikiLeaks dump that hurts then-candidate Clinton.
Is any of that a crime, though? I mean, I certainly understand why that's a matter of public concern and interest, and why it would be, you know, why it would be a thing that there would be a public interest in disclosing. But I mean, you know, this is a criminal charging document. It's, you know, it seems like it's also an important question whether that's a criminal act.
It's not a crime. It's not a criminal act. It's not against the law to talk to WikiLeaks, to hope and even encourage leaks of things damaging your political opponents. It wouldn't be a crime until you had people actively conspiring to encourage or help WikiLeaks to hack or get information by an illegal means. But this isn't the whole ball of wax. This is just one brick in the wall, and it may later shine light on other charges. This is maybe just one piece that shows the ongoing interest in what WikiLeaks and what Russian sources had to offer.
So I think a key distinction here is that it's not illegal to encourage somebody to release material that they have, but it would be illegal to encourage them to go out and commit a crime to obtain the material. So let's say, for example, that you said on national television, Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. Isn't he requesting that they commit a criminal act there? It's not just, you know, when you say if you find them, you're not going to find them on the street. You would find them by hacking into Hillary Clinton's email server, which is a crime.
Yeah, I could have sworn we talked about this like 6 months ago, but everything old is new. Yes, I remember the Trump line you're referring to, and I think the story on that remains the same, that for to prosecute somebody for conspiring or aiding and abetting, you have to show a level of specific intent. You have to show that Trump actually intended to encourage people to commit a crime as opposed to merely engaging in rhetorical hyperbole. That's the defense that has kept helping Trump in defamation claims and in all sorts of contexts. So I think the answer is that without connecting it to other things that Trump did, demonstrating a specific intent to not just bluster and joke, but to actively encourage Russians to do specific criminal acts, that it would be very hard to show a conspiracy or aiding and abetting a crime. However, it could certainly be part of the mix that Congress eventually considers if they consider impeachment, because that could be part of a pattern of things from, you know, threatening Michael Cohen's father-in-law to firing Comey to all these things that Congress could see as a pattern of obstruction of justice and criminality.
So back to Roger Stone. He's been all over television ever since he was arrested and released. Would you have advised him to engage in that publicity tour if you were his attorney?
I would have tased him and locked him in a basement, I think. But no, absolutely not.
They pay you extra for that, right, Ken?
Yeah, they do, yeah. So obviously, this is an instance where we have different strategic tracks. One strategic track may be to try to convince the President of the United States to pardon Roger Stone. And this bizarre behavior might be appropriate to that particular strategic approach. But it's certainly inappropriate to any reasonable defense in court of these criminal charges. These charges are all about knowledge and intent and what he knew when and what he meant to do and, you know, what he was thinking of when he sent these bizarre written threats and exhortations to Randy Credico. And when he goes on TV and talks about all that and makes contradictory statements about what he knew or did or intended, then it's just catnip for the prosecutors. It makes their case much easier. It makes a defense much harder.
He will be tried before Judge Amy Berman Jackson, who's a federal judge in the District of Columbia. You may remember her because she was supposed to preside over the second Paul Manafort trial, which then didn't happen because he pleaded guilty. And so I gather Roger Stone's lawyers have already gotten into a little bit of trouble with Amy Berman Jackson at this very early stage.
It was actually with a magistrate judge, with a lower level judge. But yes, so Roger Stone hired some out-of-town guys who suited his public persona and who were willing to put up with him. And they
They're
had
from
some
Florida,
troubles.
Right?
They are from Florida, where he lives. And you know, as a lawyer, you can appear in courts in other states, particularly in federal courts, but you have to go through some paperwork and go through a process called pro hoc vice, which is just basically Latin, indicating you're getting a court to recognize you as a courtesy, even though you're not admitted to the bar there. And every federal district has different paperwork and different requirements, and it's all a pain, but you have to take it seriously, and you have to go through all the silly little details that different districts want. And these lawyers were just blowing it off. They were just saying, oh, here's a piece of paper, this is close enough. And the judge in D.C. kept saying, no, that's not what the rule says. No, that's not what the rule says. And so up to literally minutes before Stone's appearance the other day, he did not have lawyers in D.C.
So let's turn to Judge Jackson and what she's overseeing with regard to Paul Manafort, because even though there wasn't a trial ultimately in her courtroom, she still has to deal with Manafort's sentencing. And there's this dispute between the Mueller team and Manafort's attorneys about whether Manafort breached his cooperation agreement by intentionally and repeatedly lying to them. And so there's been a hearing, there have been some motions, now there's been another hearing. Well, recall a few weeks ago that one thing Judge Jackson said was that the government's description of how Manafort had lied to them was too vague. And so the government filed this long memo listing out the places and that they think Manafort lied and why they think he lied about things. And I guess she said in this hearing that she still finds the government's brief to be kind of vague.
She did. This was a fairly thorough hearing, and Paul Manafort asked and received permission to be dressed in a suit for it because it was very serious. And Judge Jackson really wanted to know specifics, and she didn't want generalities or conclusions. It was clear that she takes this extremely seriously and is concerned about making the factual call about whether there was intentional lying. What's interesting to me is that, in my view, she's taking it a little more seriously than Manafort's team is, because they are not fighting it the way that I would anticipate fighting something so absolutely crucial in a case like this. They've effectively conceded that the question isn't so much the factual one of did Paul Manafort deliberately lie, but it's more a question of has the government made a good faith conclusion that he lied and therefore withdrawn from the cooperation agreement. That's obviously a much more forgiving standard to the government, and it's a little odd to me that they would in effect concede that. They do not seem to be fighting this tooth and nail the way you would expect. And I can only think it's because they realize that no matter what the outcome is, whether he breached the plea agreement or not, whether he lied or not, whether it was one lie or five or whatever it is, ultimately his sentence depends on the relative goodwill of the judge. And that's ultimately what they're fighting for. And all of this is just the opening act. And I think they're very much focused on perhaps the hope someday of a pardon, but also the hope of saving their fire and saving the judge's goodwill for the ultimate decision of how long a sentence to give him.
And so how much should this affect his sentence? I mean, we've talked about Paul Manafort as being someone who might be getting an effective life sentence because of his already fairly advanced age. So, you know, what could the delta be in terms of, you know, how much additional prison time he gets if Judge Jackson decides that he really did intentionally lie in his dealings with the government?
Well, that's the thing. It's not a bright line. It's very much up to the judge and the judge's discretion. So there are factors that could be applied under the United States Sentencing Guidelines rules, which you remember are the extremely convoluted set of rules that generate a number that's a recommendation to the judge. But those already apply based on Manafort's past conduct. You might remember that one of the things he took a hit for was for obstructing justice by trying to suborn perjury from a witness. So he already has those factors related to dishonesty and lying. So ultimately, the reason his lawyers may not be fighting this as hard as they could be is that it doesn't matter that much. It's a big number no matter what. And it's just a question of how big it's going to be. Is she going to give him 20 years or 15 years or 10 years? That might be the fight they're thinking about. And this is all just things that feed into her general ill will or goodwill, and they may be thinking, rather than go through a big fight that we may lose anyway and have her thinking already about ruling against us, we'd rather keep her goodwill and try to get a more moderate sentence.
Speaking of these criminal defendants, I want to talk briefly about Michael Cohen, who has replaced his legal team. It feels like Cohen's legal representation is mostly done, right? He pleaded guilty. He's been sentenced. He's going to report to prison in a few weeks. What would the reason be that someone would change their counsel at this time?
It could be a few reasons. He could be hoping to continue to cooperate and get a little more credit. So there are mechanisms by which the federal prosecutors can file a motion a certain amount of time after a sentencing and ask that the sentence be reduced if someone gave more cooperation after they were sentenced. So that could be part of it. It could be that he knows that he needs to navigate the difficult waters of a potential congressional appearance and continuing cooperation, because someone like Cohen is always at risk, if he continues to talk and continues to cooperate, of picking up more charges if he's seen as lying. So although most of the court action may seem to be over, he still definitely needs to be careful and not get into even more trouble, and he might have a hope of knocking a little time off his sentence.
So Michael Cohen was supposed to appear voluntarily before the House Oversight Committee. He then rescinded his acceptance of that invitation after the president publicly threatened to seek an investigation into Cohen's father-in-law. He is set to testify in closed session before the House and Senate Intelligence Committees. If the House Oversight Committee decides they really do want to hear from Cohen, can they subpoena him once he's already reported to prison? Because he's supposed to go to prison in March. Or is it the case that once he's in prison, he's basically inaccessible to Congress?
That's an interesting question. So there are a variety of mechanisms you can use to get prisoners to places where you want them to testify. Usually it's a habeas corpus motion. And how complicated it is depends on where they are and whether they're being supervised by a different government than the one that's trying to get them to testify. But Congress has mechanisms by which they could seek a court's help to get him ordered to be brought to Congress. But it would be quite a production. What I found interesting, Josh, was his rescinding his acceptance to testify. And he very much pitched it as he was concerned for his family, because, you know, the president has on repeated occasions said that someone should be investigating his father-in-law for completely unrelated issues. So query as to whether he's definitely concerned sincerely for his family and his father-in-law, or whether he's in effect helping make a case that the president is obstructing justice, that he's helping to demonstrate that these things the president is saying actually are impeding testimony that Congress wants. That seems to be in effect a slow pitch to Congress for an impeachment discussion.
It's also conceivable that he has unrelated reasons why he realized it would be unwise to appear voluntarily, and this is a useful excuse for rescinding his agreement to do so, right?
Sure. And for all we know, Congress has worked that out with him, and it's all theater.
When we come back, we will talk about our current and future attorneys general. You are listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with Attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. I want to talk about Acting Attorney General Matt Whitaker, who said at a press conference that the Mueller investigation is, quote, I think close to being completed, unquote. We have heard rumors and hopes and wishes that this investigation might be wrapping up. Certainly not wishes from people who are in the Donald Trump Legal Problems podcast industry. We want this to continue forever. But anyway, this is the first time that an on-the-record comment from a Justice Department official says that at least he thinks that the thing is about to come to an end. Does this mean anything that Whitaker said this?
I don't think that it does. It wasn't put in a way that inspires confidence. It wasn't surrounded by any specifics or any indications that he had reason to know it. It seemed more like a wish than a fact. And it was delivered during a press conference in which Whitaker was sweating so profusely that I think some people were significantly concerned for his health. And so I think it was more messaging than reality.
Does Robert Mueller even know when this investigation is going to end? I mean, what if they learn something new and important and interesting in that search of Roger Stone's house? Isn't it the nature of an investigation like this that you might discover new facts in the course of investigating that cause you to lengthen your timeline of how long the investigation is going to take?
Absolutely, particularly when you're given the right to go after things that you find during the course of the investigation. So particularly when they are as vigorously interviewing and searching and subpoenaing as the special counsel has, it's definitely very open-ended.
Whitaker also said that he's, quote, comfortable that the decisions that were made are going to be reviewed, you know, either through the various means we have, unquote. So that statement's not even grammatical. But some Democrats on Capitol Hill were alarmed by his comment about reviewing Mueller's activity. Is that something that one should be alarmed about?
I'm not sure it's coherent enough to be alarmed about. I mean, he gets to review, he himself or whoever is sitting in the AG's chair, what the special counsel has done. The special counsel regulation calls for that. And Congress, theoretically, can review what went on depending on the type of report they wound up with. So I don't find it specific enough to be a credible threat that he's saying, basically, you know, someone's going to be coming for the special counsel based on what he did.
When you say who's going to be sitting in that chair, it's not likely to be Matt Whitaker. The Senate Judiciary Committee should vote on February 7 on the nomination of Bill Barr to become the real and true Attorney General. That should leave time for Matt Whitaker to testify before the House Judiciary Committee on February 8. I don't think the Senate will have had time to confirm Barr by then, but sooner or later, Bill Barr is going to be Attorney General. And Bill Barr has said something that also has some Democrats on Capitol Hill concerned, and even some Republicans, which is basically, Barr has talked about how there are obligations of the Justice Department to avoid making derogatory statements about uncharged parties when it is discussing criminal investigations. And now, of course, they are not going to charge the president because the president is, you know, there's this Department of Justice guidance that we often talk about that you can't indict a sitting president. And so some people are concerned that this would become a cover for withholding information that Mueller has discovered about the president because the president is going to be an uncharged party and the DOJ has certain obligations to protect him as it would any private citizen who was not being charged at the end of a criminal investigation.
Sure. I think people may be reading somewhat too much into this than Barr intended. Barr is a old Department of Justice hand. He's very much immersed in the culture and the rules. And it is true that the Department of Justice makes some efforts not to trash talk people that they aren't charging. The only unusual part of it is applying it to a special counsel report. I'm not sure that Barr is saying that we're not going to release a report that says bad things about the president, because there's certainly in the Starr report and other prior things, there's ample precedent for putting out reports that talk about the president's conduct. So is it something that Congress should look at very carefully and watch to see whether they're getting a watered-down version? Absolutely. But I don't take it as the sinister prediction that some people are.
I mean, we've already learned derogatory information about the president's behavior from some of these prosecutorial filings. In particular, Michael Cohen's plea in the Southern District of New York makes clear that individual one, who is clearly the president, directed him to engage in making this illegal campaign contribution. So it seems the precedent is already there that these prosecutors could disclose negative information about the president without indicting him. Does their obligation, is it really just limited to not referring to him by name? Because it seems like, you know, I realize that can often be a charade, but this seems like the height of it being a charade when there's an immense amount of public attention and it is completely obvious. I mean, when you describe individual one as somebody who ran a successful presidential campaign in 2016, that's a set of one person. So if that is it really this like totally ministerial thing where it's like just, you know, don't speak the name Donald Trump in the report?
It can be. So the circumstances under which you have to not be derogatory towards third parties can really be just literally you shouldn't name them completely openly and gratuitously, even if any reasonably intelligent person can look at all the facts and work out who it is. So that's another reason that I don't find these comments about the special counsel's report that shocking, because the report could be brought into compliance with that tradition and that policy without making it particularly difficult to figure out what the report's talking about.
Finally, I would like to talk about the Kushner family. Listeners will likely recall that the original source of the bad blood between Jared Kushner and Chris Christie is that Christie put Charles Kushner, Jared's father, in prison when Christie was the U.S. attorney for New Jersey. Christie's now on a book tour, and he discussed his relations with the Kushners on Firing Line with Margaret Hoover on PBS.
I want to talk about Jared Kushner, because frankly, it comes down that he's the one who fired you, right?
That's what Steve Bannon told me, yes.
And you believe that?
Sure.
Right. You believe that because there's history between the two of you.
Between me and his father, not between me and him.
But you can understand why he takes it personally.
Yes and no.
Would you separate your experience if your father had been put in jail from the prosecutor who put him in jail?
If my father was guilty, I would. Mr. Kushner pled guilty. He admitted the crimes. And so what am I supposed to do as a prosecutor? I mean, if a guy hires a prostitute to seduce his brother-in-law and videotapes it and then sends the videotape to his sister to attempt to intimidate her from testifying before a grand jury, do I really need any more justification than that? I mean, it's one of the most loathsome, disgusting crimes that I prosecuted when I was U.S. attorney. And I was U.S. attorney in New Jersey, Margaret, so we had some loathsome and disgusting crime going on there.
So he has a point, right, that the Kushner case is sort of memorably prurient, even by the standards of things that a U.S. attorney might bring charges over, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it takes the Kushner family to make Chris Christie likable and reasonable. And he's got a perfectly reasonable point that what Kushner Sr. did was very vivid and memorable, and anyone would have gotten tagged for that.
Do you find that relatives of clients base how forgiving they are toward the U.S. attorney on how much the client really deserved to go to prison? Is, your father was a bad guy who deserved to go to jail. Do people find that to be a convincing argument?
No, unless they were already inclined to be mad at their relative anyway. I think generally people's relationship with their relatives who get prosecuted just play out in other forums, and this one is very typical. People are going to support their loved ones, and they're going to find a way to rationalize that, you know, everyone's doing it, or they went after this person too hard, he didn't deserve that sentence, they didn't get it right, whatever it is, they'll usually find a way. They don't tend to say, oh yeah, he had it coming, unless they had that negative relationship with the relative to begin with.
Everyone is setting his brother-in-law up with a prostitute and videotaping it in order to intimidate their sister out of testifying before a grand jury?
Was that wrong? Should I have done that? The other thing I think is just interesting here is how it demonstrates that Chris Christie is sort of no longer under Trump's shadow, but off the leash, that he is very much now adverse to this White House. And it will be interesting to see what else comes out of that.
There is so much for us to talk about, but I think that is a good place for us to leave it this week. Ken White, thank you for speaking with me again.
Thank you, Josh.
We have another Left, Right, and Center episode coming up for you on Friday. There's already a lot to talk about this week. We'll talk about negotiations that are trying to avert a second government shutdown. We'll talk about the campaign that everybody has been clamoring for, Howard Schultz for president. And we're going to talk with Sarah Cliff from Vox about ER bills. She's done a really interesting reporting project on how the prices that emergency rooms charge patients seem to be generated almost at random. To get that episode, make sure you're subscribed to Left, Right, and Center on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have questions about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, send us your questions. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW and on Facebook, too. This episode of All the President's Lawyers was produced by Sarah Fay and Laura Dine Million. Our associate producer is Rosalie Atkinson. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us. And Ken and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.